You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On June 9, 2006, three detainees at Guantanamo Bay Prison died sudden and violent deaths, all at roughly the same time. The official report states that the men hanged themselves in a synchronized suicide plot, but now questions are being raised about whether that's what really happened. Scott Horton, an attorney, human rights activist, and a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, joins us now. His article, The Guantanamo Suicides, A Camp Delta Sergeant Blows the Whistle, appears in the March issue of his magazine, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Great to be with you.
In the title of the article, the word suicides is in quotes to imply that you believe these deaths should not really be classified as suicides?
Yes, I think that certainly the claim that the government put forward that they were suicides has been strongly undermined, and there's quite substantial evidence to suggest that they may not have been suicides, yes.
Well, if you had decided to make it homicides, would you have had to put that in quotes as well?
There's still some possibility that some evidence could be put forward for a suicide theory. I think at this point it's quite clear that the specific suicide theory that the government advanced, that these three prisoners had hung themselves in their cells in a synchronized way that evening, is almost certainly untrue. The evidence suggests very strongly that they died at a different location, and they died probably in the course of some special interrogation session.
Well, the men were found bound, weren't they? One had his feet bound, and all three had their hands bound. Wouldn't that make hanging yourself quite difficult?
And indeed, experts I've spoken with about this, including Dr. Michael Bodden, the former medical examiner in New York City, says that there is no reported case of a suicide that comes anywhere near the facts that the government reported here. There are very few, very, very rare cases of suicides committed with people binding their hands and feet. Usually these are cases of insurance fraud where the deceased wanted to appear to have been murdered so that insurance proceeds could be collected upon. The facts that clearly weren't present here.
Is that what's being claimed, that they wanted to make it look like they were being murdered?
No, not at all. What's being claimed is that this was a synchronized suicide technique and that they had even stuffed cloth down their mouths. In fact, the Department of Defense states that they did that so as to muffle any noise that may have come out of their mouths in the course of their suicide. But that is absolutely senseless claim.
Have people had their mouths stuffed as part of the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques?
We do have a number of reported cases in which individuals were muffled or silenced by having cloth placed in their mouths, and we have one reported case coming out of Iraq in which this restraining technique was linked directly to the death of a prisoner.
If they say that they put the cloth in their mouth to prevent themselves from screaming out, as I understand it, when you're hanged, it's so instantaneous, there's really no noise that comes out, or just a quick sigh.
That's right. The claim doesn't make any sense.
So who were these three men who died at Guantanamo on June 9, 2006? How did they wind up in the prison in the first place?
Well, one, Mr. Al-Salmi, is from Yemen. Al-Utaibi was from Saudi Arabia, and Yasser al-Zarani was from Saudi Arabia. They were picked up either in Pakistan or in Afghanistan. They were all turned over to the United States for bounty payments. And one of the fascinating things about them, while at the time of their deaths, they were described by the Pentagon as being vicious, ferocious terrorists. In fact, one public affairs officer described them as the sort of Nazis that we tried at Nuremberg. It turned out subsequently, when internal and intelligence reports were declassified and released, that the Pentagon had in fact concluded that none of the three people were in fact properly held at Guantanamo, and all were being set to be released. And in fact, Mr. Al-Utaibi probably would have been released and returned home to Saudi Arabia within a matter of roughly 2.5 weeks after the day on which he died. There's some evidence to suggest he knew that. His family believed certainly that he knew that. And we learned that Yasser al-Zarani probably would have been the next person released after him. And Mr. al-Sami, the only problem with him was that he was from Yemen, and the U.S. really had poor diplomatic relations with Yemen, still does, and that stands in the way of release and repatriation. So none of these were people who in the view of the military, were the sort of people we wanted to capture and hold in Guantanamo to begin with.
So why would anyone want to kill them?
That's a very good question. And why would they have been taken off for special interrogation that evening? It appears that these three, while there's really nothing to suggest that they were violent terrorists, that's not to say necessarily that they were nice people. Certainly, from the perspective of the prison administration, all three of them have been involved in a hunger strike at the prison, and they had been quite loud in articulating their dissatisfaction with the prison conditions and their protests. So they were definitely difficult prisoners. And in fact, that's why they were being held in the Alpha cell block in Camp 1, which was a cell block reserved for difficult prisoners who were subject to constant monitoring. Now, that fact, in the end of the day, makes it puzzling that they could have committed suicide. They were supposed to have been checked at least once every 10 minutes by a prison guard.
And if they checked, they had rigor mortis when they were found, didn't they?
When they were found, they had been dead for 2 hours, according to the Naval Criminal Investigative Service report. And that suggests that at least a dozen times guards failed to detect them. Or maybe there's another explanation for this, because the key account that we publish in this article comes from a group of Maryland military intelligence soldiers who were providing the tower guard service that evening at the camp. And they tell a completely different story about what happened. They record that evening a paddy wagon, they called it, a prisoner transport vehicle, pulled up in front of Camp 1 and took a prisoner from that camp to a secret facility that they referred to as Camp No. In fact, it made 3 separate round trips in the course of an hour, removing 3 prisoners from that cell block and taking them to this secret detention facility. And then they observe that prisoner transportation vehicle pulled up in front of the detainee clinic, having evidently discharged some passengers around 11 o'clock at night, later in the evening. So according to their information, these three prisoners would have died at Camp No.
My guest is Scott Horton, who's a contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. His article, The Guantanamo Suicides, Camp Delta Sergeant Blows the Whistle, is in the current issue of that magazine. It's called Camp No for obvious reasons.
That's right. It's called Camp No because the soldiers, all of whom knew about it and had observed it over a period of many months, all understood that if anyone asked a question about it, they were supposed to answer, no, it does not exist.
Well, how much corroborating evidence is there that this alleged site does exist or is still operating?
Well, its existence is not being denied by the Pentagon. They won't make further comments on it. But in fact, you can look at satellite photography of the Guantanamo enclave, and it's clearly there. We have gathered, I think, altogether now 6 or 7 eyewitness accounts of the facility, some of them quite detailed. So all the soldiers who did perimeter guard duty came across it at some point, knew about it. And it was only a short distance away from Camp Delta, roughly a mile, a little bit more than a mile, nestled between two ridges so that it couldn't be seen easily from a distance. You had to come up right on it before you could see it. And it looked like the detention facilities in Camp Delta. It seems to have been built about the same time using roughly the same construction materials.
Well, President Bush acknowledged that the CIA had a black sites program in 2006, but didn't President Obama order it shut down?
Well, in fact, President Bush did. He made an announcement in September 2006 in which he stated that these black sites were being shut down, and they transferred the CIA's prisoners to Guantanamo, to a special new facility in Guantanamo, Camp 7. And the location of Camp 7 is closely guarded, but I can tell you the camp is not Camp 7. I know where Camp 7 is. And it doesn't appear to have been used to hold prisoners on a continuous basis. Instead, it seems to have been used for transitory interrogation operations. So prisoners would be brought there for a couple of hours or maybe a day. They'd be interrogated and they'd be brought back. So it wasn't a residential facility.
Well, we mentioned earlier that the claim was that they did the synchronized suicides as a form of protest. How much interaction was there between the various prisoners at Guantanamo?
Well, the interaction was greatly restricted, and certainly, although these three prisoners were in the same cell block, they were not in adjacent cells, and they had no way of communicating with one another. They could, during breaks, they could occasionally exchange some words and have some conversations, but that was quite infrequently.
It's charged that they all died pretty much at the same time. Why is that an important detail?
Yeah, in fact, the medical evidence suggests that they died more or less simultaneously, and that suggests then, according to the official narrative, that they had to bound their hands, bound their feet, stuffed cloth down their throats, put a mask over the face to hold the cloth in place, stepped on top of a wash basin while their feet were bound, mind you, fastened a noose to the top of a wire wall, which was roughly 8 feet tall, slipped the neck through, tightened it, and jumped off to commit suicide. And they all did this simultaneously. It is a literally impossible scenario. So I think the timing is one of the things that suggests it just can't possibly be correct. But the alternative scenario that's presented by the tower guards is that they were removed to this detention facility, and it would suggest that something happened to them at more or less the same time. I mean, certainly within half an hour.
Although suicides as a form of protest are not unique. In 2005, the Associated Press quoted the military in a report that 23 suspects had tried to hang or strangle themselves at Guantanamo, and added that there were 350 self-harm incidents at the prison that in 2003 included 120 so-called hanging gestures. That sounds like hanging is on a lot of people's mind.
Well, I think there's no question about that. In fact, just generally, suicide is an issue in a prison anywhere in the world. And that means that prisons are set up to address that problem. And they have procedures in place to make it much more difficult for prisoners to commit suicide. Those procedures would include things like having constant observation of the cells, limiting the linen rations, the blankets and sheets that are given to them, and so forth. And indeed, we see that at Camp Delta, there was a very rigorous set of procedures in place to guard against suicides that really would have made the sort of suicides that occurred here impossible. In fact, I'll give you another nugget that was not included in my story, but going through the NCIS materials, one of the guards in their cell block recounts that she had done a cell linen count that afternoon, that is between 3 and 5 p.m. of the day on which they died, had looked at the three cells, examined and shook out every single sheet and blanket that was there, And this guard states that, in fact, the materials that were used to bind the hands and feet, to stuff a cloth down the mouth, the face mask, as well as the noose, none of these materials were present in the cells at 5 p.m. that evening.
Did these guys leave suicide notes?
That's a major issue. In fact, that's another very, very interesting thing. The records reflecting examination of the bodies immediately on their removal from the cells don't reflect these notes. And in fact, one witness talks about administering choriopulmonary resuscitation to one of the prisoners, Al-Zarani, that involved putting a fist over the heart area and pumping it. And that witness says, you know, there was no note there. But a day later, there's a report suddenly that there was a note in his shirt pocket that the man was pumping on top of, in fact. And we have notes showing up in the pockets of all three prisoners. And these notes have remarkably similar texts with similar statements. And NCIS says, well, you see, this is more evidence of a conspiracy because they're writing more or less the same thing. Of course, I took one of these notes and showed it to the father of young Al-Zarani, who almost immediately told me, this is a forgery. This wasn't written by my son. So, you know, we certainly have a challenge as to whether or not those suicide notes were legitimate suicide notes.
My guest is Scott Norton, a contributing editor at Harper's. His article, The Guantanamo Suicides, is in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Scott Horton, the author of an article called The Guantanamo Suicides, A Camp Delta Sergeant Blows the Whistle, published in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. And in the article, you described the black site system as an archipelago. Well, given that you worked with Soviet human rights campaigner Andrei Sakharov, I can't help but wonder if you were deliberately comparing the U.S. government's terrorist prison network to the Soviet Gulag, which was detailed in Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago.
Well, there's some similarities, but I think there are an awful lot of differences. The biggest difference between them is the simple human throughput, because you saw millions of people put through this Soviet detention system, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, who died in that system. And by comparison, the CIA system held perhaps 150 or 200 people, so it was a very, very small-scale operation.
Part of the article is a bit gruesome, and I'm going to get into a little bit of that. So if people have weak stomachs, they may not want to listen for the next few minutes. You write about the removal of the neck organs by military pathologists who conducted the autopsies on the three detainees. Is that a standard procedure when they're looking at a hanging or a strangulation victim?
Yes, it absolutely is. So when the death occurs as a result of neck compression, they usually want to take that material out and examine it very carefully and preserve it, because that material will tell you specifically whether someone died as a result of hanging, as a result of strangulation, or as a result of choking. And I think those are the three theories that obviously suggest themselves here. I think there's no question but that neck compression caused the deaths, that it was an asphyxiation of some sort. But there's a lot of lack of clarity as to the specifics of the asphyxiation. And certainly these bodies all were found with cloth stuffed down the throats past the gagging point. And the camp commander gathered the guards the morning after the deaths together and alerted them to the fact that while these three prisoners had died as a result of choking on cloths, that's what he said to all the assembled guards, that nevertheless the camp was going to go, or the base was going to go with a different story to the media. People would hear on the media that they had hung themselves in their cells. And he instructed the guards that they were not to any way question or undermine that official account, even though, of course, they knew it wasn't true.
And how long did the guards abide by that agreement?
for quite some time. In fact, I interviewed a large number of them who confirmed that he had made this statement. And they say, by the way, he pointed out to them that their communications, telephone and emails were all being monitored, and they had all been placed under very strict orders to keep this Guantanamo secrets. And they honored that rigorously. And in fact, Joe Hickman, the staff sergeant who provided the essential narrative here, tells me that he only felt that he was free to come forward and tell the story after President Bush left office and Barack Obama arrived. And even then, only after Barack Obama signed a presidential order for the closing of Guantanamo and banning torture and so forth, he tells me he felt at that moment that it was okay for him to come forward and tell the truth.
And he not only talked to you, he spoke to the Justice Department, members of Congress. What happened after he did that?
Well, in fact, I think we got to turn it around. In fact, he told me I hate reporters. I learned when I started exploring this with him that he didn't want to speak to the media about this. He had, in fact, had gone to the Justice Department and some attorneys. He wanted law enforcement to look into this and handle it. He didn't want it to be all over the newspapers. But I think he finally went to the press when it was clear to him that this had been covered up in the Bush administration and that the Obama administration had settled on a policy of just keeping the lid on things.
Well, at the time, the media reported the suicides were a form of asymmetrical warfare. What does that mean?
That's right. In fact, that was the claim that was made by Admiral Harris, the commander at Guantanamo. And I went back and I pulled out all those media accounts that appeared roughly in the month and a half after the deaths. And what you see, you do not see independent investigation or reporting in any of them. Basically, all the media reports are simply restating the official briefings that were given by Pentagon Public Affairs and Guantanamo Public Affairs. There's little independent reporting. There was not even an attempt to reach out to the families of the deceased and interview them.
Did anybody, Harris, Sergeant Hickman, because Colonel Bumgardner, the colonel who earlier said that the rags had been stuffed in the detainees' throats, had his office raided by the FBI, didn't he?
Indeed, he had his office raided by the FBI, and he wound up being fired as the camp commander within a matter of, just a couple of weeks after this incident. And official statements were made by the Pentagon making it very clear that Bumgardner was relieved because he had divulged to the public highly sensitive or classified information. And comparing the official Pentagon statements with the public statements that were made by Bumgardner, it's very clear that the super sensitive information he divulged was the fact that each of these three prisoners was found dead with cloth stuffed down their mouth, which is, I think, the way they actually died. And it's very, very clear that the Pentagon was extremely keen to keep that secret.
My guest is Scott Horton. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and his article, The Guantanamo Suicides, appears in the March issue of Harper's. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The autopsy reveals that certain things happened to these men's necks that wouldn't have occurred during a hanging. Isn't that true?
Well, that's correct.
Is it the hyoid bone was broken?
That's exactly right. The hyoid bone of one of these three prisoners was broken, and that's something that is consistent with manual strangulation, not with with death by hanging. And indeed, there were markings on the body that were consistent with torture or other physical abuse. And the second pathologist in Switzerland who examined it found a number of markings on the throat that were inconsistent with death by hanging. But the independent pathologists who attempted to review this were unable to make a final conclusion because the U.S. government had removed the neck material and refused to provide it to the second team of pathologists performing an independent examination. In fact, on this point, after I wrote about this, the Pentagon came forward and said that the families had never requested this material. But I subsequently published, in fact, the letter in which they requested it. Not only that, but I also examined the email correspondence between one of the senior pathologists in Switzerland and the senior U.S. Navy pathologist who had supervised the government's examination, who wrote in an email that he would love to cooperate with the Swiss doctors, but he had been ordered not to cooperate with them.
No, I don't understand. You can remove parts of a body when you return the body to the family?
It's certainly not considered standard procedure to withhold body parts. I mean, certainly those body parts should have been returned to the body and turned over for burial. They could be withheld if there's an ongoing criminal investigation and there's a sense that that may be necessary to be used as evidence in the criminal investigation. So I think to this extent, it's very curious that they removed the neck material and insisted on holding on to it. No. And in fact, that the NCIS investigation was held open for a period of several years without being concluded.
Now, we're talking about a cover-up, but who's doing this cover-up? Is this the military? Is this the people at Guantanamo Bay? Is this the Justice Department?
Well, I think the evidence we have suggests, in fact, that the Justice Department is involved in the cover-up almost from the beginning, because we talked about the camp commander's quarters being raided. That was the FBI. The FBI was brought in only days after the deaths occurred, and it was brought in to conduct a leak investigation, which was widely telegraphed all over the base, which essentially sending a message to everyone that if you talk about what happened here, you're going to be in big trouble, and it's going to be with the FBI. I interviewed, in fact, several senior military officials who told me that that investigation would not have been arranged by the Pentagon. The request would have come from some other place in Washington, most likely the National Security Council.
And what's That's happening today? We've had a total turnover at Justice, haven't we?
We have, and we know that an investigation was launched. In fact, the day that Eric Holder went to Capitol Hill for his hearings, they began an investigation, and it seems to have been ongoing for roughly 1 week, and then it mysteriously was shut down. Well, subsequently, of course, Charlie Savage in the New York Times and Jay Mayer and the New Yorker have both reported that the White House was intervening and pressing the Justice Department extremely aggressively not to look into issues relating to abuse in the war on terror, particularly connected with interrogation abuse. It seems pretty clear that this investigation was shut down before it ever really got going.
By the White House.
I think so. I mean, very, very clear. Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod both specifically identified as bringing pressure to bear on the Justice Department not to conduct any investigations.
The ACLU has obtained a number of memos written in the Bush Justice Department on harsh interrogation techniques. Are you suggesting in all of this that the techniques spelled out in those memos have somehow contributed to these 3 alleged suicides?
Well, we don't know exactly. We know they were taken to this special facility, which appears to have been used by the CIA, but possibly also by JSOC, for some sort of special process. We know even in 2006, the Justice Department was giving a sign-off for the use of special harsh techniques on prisoners, including prisoners held at Guantanamo. And, of course, we have the Internal Inspector General's report from the CIA suggesting that some prisoners died in connection with these techniques and others suffered serious harm in connection with their application. So all this would suggest that, of course, the Justice Department would have every reason not to want to have to deal with the investigation of a death related to the use of techniques it approved. And we have one other very interesting development here, which is that the person inside the Justice Department assigned to conduct the investigations, a woman named Teresa McHenry, and in reviewing the Justice Department documents, we find that she provided critical input to the preparation of 2 of these torture memoranda.
Well, you write that in June 2009, 6 months after Barack Obama took office, one of the 200 men imprisoned at Guantanamo was found dead in his cell, and the exact circumstances of his death, like those of these three men from Alpha Block, remain uncertain. You're not suggesting that these things are continuing to happen, are you?
Absolutely. That is what I'm suggesting. And in that case, the authorities in Guantanamo immediately claimed that the death was a suicide. And they have, following the examination of the case by a number of medical experts, they have been forced to step back from that claim. And that death is now under formal investigation as a homicide.
Following the deaths of the three so-called suicides, the Naval Criminal Investigation Service also seized every piece of paper possessed by every single prisoner in Guantanamo, much of it attorney-client correspondence. What was the justification for that action?
Well, they said the suicide notes appeared to be have been written on some of these attorney-client privileged materials. And the Justice Department went before a federal judge trying to justify the seizure, saying that these attorney-client privileged materials were used by the prisoners to write and pass notes to one another and to engage in other sorts of nefarious plans. Now, stepping back, I've talked to several criminal investigators, including an FBI agent who has extensive experience in dealing with suicides and particularly fake suicides. And I was told that, in fact, where someone wants to fake a suicide note, it would be standard practice to try and find a piece of paper that was already imprinted with the fingerprints of the deceased. So it would have more legitimacy. And so I think that may very well be what happened here. But in any event, the Justice Department made representations about the suicide notes and about the suicides to a federal court that just don't stand up right now. It's pretty clear that they made false statements.
The president has pledged to close Guantanamo and to try all of the people who were there who might be guilty of something, although it looks like the administration is going to have to back down on some of that because of the response to it. In looking at this case and the Obama administration's response to it, do you have a sense that we finally turned a corner on President Bush's national security policies?
Well, I think that apart from this case, there's no question but that a lot was changed inside of Guantanamo after these events in 2006. I mean, Camp 1, for instance, where these prisoners were held, was shut down. The only facility that's now used is a much better, much healthier facility. I think the terms and procedures that are used at the camp are much more humane. And I think maybe the president will succeed in closing down Guantanamo by the end of the year. On the other hand, we now have Bagram being set up, and I think we have a major issue looming on the horizon as to whether or not Bagram is just going to be turned into Guantanamo North.
Have there been similar alleged suicides in Bagram?
Indeed, if you go back and we look at the first really vivid and fully validated accounts of torture, the ones that were portrayed by Alex Gibney in his Academy Award-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side, that was at Bagram Prison.
Mm-hmm. The article that we're talking about, the Guantanamo Suicides, a Camp Delta Sergeant Blows the Whistle, is in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. My great thanks to Scott Horton for talking with us.
Great pleasure to be with you.